I'd like to call to order the February 4, 2004 meeting of the House Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. Clerk, would you retake the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland? Anderson?
Here.
Blaine?
Here.
Ellison?
Here.
Fuller? Hillstrom?
Here.
Hilty?
Here.
Johnson?
Here.
Lesh?
Here.
Littman?
Here.
Meslow?
Here.
Murphy? Tamar? Powell?
Here.
Rhodes? Soderstrom?
Here.
Strand? Tao? Walls?
Here.
We do have a quorum. Before we proceed, I want to immediately thoroughly embarrass our new staff member, Tim Jacobson. Stand up. He's our new page, so if anybody needs anything. Next item on the agenda is the consideration of the minutes. We have two sets in the packet. The first one is meeting from April 15, 2003. Representative Lippman moves approval. Any additions or corrections? If not, motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion adopted. Minutes approved. The next is the January 27, 2003 minutes. Representative Blaine moves approval. Any questions or comments? If not, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Minutes are approved. All right. We have just completed our trip to the Capitol Rotunda on the Methamphetamine Awareness Day presentation. The next and last item before us will be the report to the legislature on drug offender sentencing issues. I'd ask you to keep your presentation to approximately 30 minutes, and then we will have any questions. We will try to get out of here by 11:45. I apologize for any tight agenda here this morning, but our day has been somewhat tightened up by events later in the day, so we'll see what we can do to accommodate everyone. All right. You give us your name. We are taping this for a public record. Give us your name and then proceed.
My name is Barbara Toons. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And during the 2003 special session, the legislature requested that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to examine...
Hang on just one second. I'm having trouble hearing, and I think others are. We're going to check your mic. Representative Rhodes,
we had the same problem in this room yesterday for a hearing, and we had to bring in somebody back and forth, and... they may have to use the other mic. That we found that also. Some are working better than others.
Desk, is that better?
Can you hear now?
Physically try to get closer. If it's uncomfortable, we may move you over to the gentleman.
Can you hear me now? I feel like a Verizon commercial.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. During the 2003 legislative special session, the Minnesota Legislature requested the Sentencing Guidelines Commission in SF 2, Section 14, examine a variety of issues related to drug offender sentencing. These issues were laid out in quite detail, and the Sentencing Commission took that directive and worked on it this summer to produce a report that was distributed to you on January 15th. There was approximately 8 subsections in that report, and the Commission addressed all of those subsections with the exclusion of subsection 8, which was the request for a recidivism study. For a recidivism study to be conducted with any validity and reliability, the time frame for the submission of this report and the design that would be necessary to do the analysis to give you a viable product just was not possible. And we set that forth in the report. We did note that recidivism statistics and results from other states and nationwide were presented in the report. Okay. We looked at the number of felony convictions for drug offenders, and this is for all offenders who had a felony conviction, which is different than the prison admissions. And what we saw was there was a 20.2% increase between 2001 and 2002, which is a significant increase in felony sentencing for drug offenders in one single year. And it's the largest increase since the enactment of the guidelines in 1980. Then we also looked at the number of felony drug convictions. Between in 1991, we had approximately 1,693 felony sentences for drug drug offenses. By 2002, that had increased to 3,424 sentences. So you basically doubled the amount of people who were sentenced for felony drug offenses in that 12-year period of time. You saw a 32% increase in the number of felony drug sentences between 2001 and 2002, whereas you saw a 17% increase in all other felony sentences. So what this data is telling you is that you had an increase overall in the number of felony sentences in the state, but it was significantly higher for felony drug offenses than it was for other types of felony offenses. Then we looked at the growth in sentencing by individual drug degrees. You have five drug degrees in the state, with first degree being the most serious and fifth degree being the least serious. The first degree offenses grew by 62% between 2001 and 2002. This is primarily attributable to the methamphetamine increase the state has experienced over the past few years, since they are manufacture of meth and possession of meth and so forth are designated first-degree drug offenses. There was a 49% increase in number of meth manufacture cases alone. It had increased from 109 cases in 2001 to 162 cases in 2002. And then you also experienced a 70% increase in the number of first-degree possession and in first-degree sale offenses. First degree, just for to clarify, contains both methamphetamines and several other types of drugs. So when I gave you the methamphetamine data, that was for that drug specifically, and then the others for all the other remaining drugs and narcotics classified as first degree. Then we looked at what are the drugs of choice or use in this state that are driving these types of convictions. And you will see that cocaine remains the most predominantly ingested drug in this state. Meth is increasing significantly over the past 6 years. And you can see, just for an example here, in 1996, 48% of the drug convictions were for for cocaine. In 2002, that had dropped to 40%. So you're starting to see a decrease in the use of cocaine across the state. In 1996, you had 24% of the convictions for marijuana. By 2002, that had dropped to 13%. So again, your marijuana usage has been cut in about half in that period of time. And amphetamines, or methamphetamines, as they're commonly known, was only 14% of the convictions in 1996. However, that has increased to 38% of your convictions in 2002. So where you're seeing a decrease in some of the other drugs, you're seeing a significant more than doubling in the methamphetamine. Okay, you're also seeing a shift in the regional distribution of where the drug sentences are coming from. In the past couple years, you've seen more an increase to the greater Minnesota area. Again, this is directly correlated with the manufacture of meth, which is a drug that's used more often and more commonly in the rural and the outer metro areas than into the urban cities. In 1996, 35% of your drug convictions came from greater Minnesota. In 2002, that had increased to 45%. So you're seeing about 10% increase in the drug sentences coming from the greater Minnesota area. Also, the introduction of methamphetamine and its widespread use in the state has affected the racial makeup of what's happening in, as far as drug convictions in the state. In 1999, 51% of your drug convictions were for whites, and 36% were for African Americans. By 2002, the percentage had increased to 58% for whites and decreased 31% for African Americans. Again, this is a product or a byproduct of the fact that methamphetamines appears to be a drug of use or choice among the white population, more so the minority. So you're starting to see that shift in the racial composition of your drug offender population. Then we looked at the imprisonment rates. Who is sent to prison for drug offenders, for drug sentencing? 27% of all drug convictions involved an executed prison sentence. I mean, the offender was sentenced to serve his time in a state correctional facility. This compares to 22% of the non-drug crimes that are given executed sentences. So you're seeing a higher percentage of people being sent to prison for the drug offenses and non-drug. And again, this is primarily a function of the fact that a lot of your methamphetamines are drug level ones, and drug level ones and twos are presumptive prison sentences in the state. So it ties in that you should start seeing an increase in your imprisonment rate. In 1991, only 13% of your drug offenders went to prison in the state. In 2000-2001, that increased to 24%, and by 2002, it's up to 27%. So you've more than doubled the number of people who are being sentenced to prison, in addition to the volume and the number of people being sentenced across the board for drug offenders. For non-drug offenses in 1991, you had 21% of your people going to prison. And between 92 and 2000, that has only increased between 22 and 24%. So there has not been much growth. It's fluctuated a little bit, with 24% being the highest number of people. Then you looked at, what you can take from this is you have more people being sentenced for prison, for offenses across the state, a significantly larger portion of those people being sentenced for drug offenses, and you have a larger number of people being admitted to prison. And then you tie on top of that the fact that your average pronounced sentences for drug offenders has increased significantly over the past years. Currently in 2002, the average pronounced sentence was 50 months. In 1991, that sentence was 36 months. You can see the growth there. The average sentence for non-drug offenders is 49 months. So you've actually exceeded the average sentence for drugs over the non-drug offenders. And in 91, that average sentence was 46 months. So you haven't seen a whole lot of growth in your non-drug sentences as far as lengths of sentences or average sentences imposed, but you have in your drug offenders. Part of this is an impact of your 1998 legislation that revised your drug statutes, and the way you can see this most eloquently, or the way I can explain it to you most eloquently, is just to give you some scenarios. In 1991, you had 217 drug offenders sentenced to prison, and they served an average of 36 months. In 2001, you had 623 drug offenders going to prison, and they were serving an average of 47 months. In 2002, you had 938 drug offenders going to prison, and they were serving an average of 50 months. Prison population takes into consideration a lot of variables to determine how long your people will go to prison, or how many people are in your prison. But there's two basic things: who goes to prison and how long they stay. And so what's happening here is you're having an increase corresponding at the same time with the number of people going to prison and how long they're staying. And those two things coming together is what's driving this population so quickly. Okay. There's three ways people go to prison in the state. They're either sentenced directly from the courts, which are called initial commits. The court sends you there. You're put on probation. You violate your probation, meaning you either commit a new crime, but most of the time it's a condition of the probation that they violate, and they are subsequently incarcerated, or they are released after serving a term of incarceration and they violate the terms of their supervised release and they come back into prison. So those are the three ways people enter a state correctional facility. When you look at the number of people who have entered prison over the past 12 years, you see the same pattern that you saw with the increase in sentencing. Your population has gone from 2,180 people admitted to prison in 1990 to 3,705 people admitted to prison in 2002. So that's basically about 1,525 more people you've admitted to prison in a 12-year period. You've seen an unprecedented number of females entered prison last year. It was the highest since we have had data available 394 females entered your state correctional facilities. Now, taking into consideration, this is significantly a lower population than males, but it is something to be take note of, that you have females entering at that rate. Males increased 13% between 2001 and 2002, but your females increased 36%. And then we looked at the types of offenses when people come into prison. So we know that more people are being coming into prison. What are they coming into prison for? Because before you make any policy changes, you have to understand what is currently going on that's driving your population, or you can get yourself really confused. So drug, if you look here, for the first time in 2002, you have more drug offenders going to prison than any other offense category, and that includes person, property, and others. And what the other category is crimes such as DWI, felon in possession of a firearm, failure to register for a predatory sex offense, eluding a police officer. They're crimes that have been basically established in the last 10 to 12 years, and they don't really fit property, but they don't really fit person, so we put them in the other category. And so that's why you see that large growth in that category, too, because you've added several offenses that fit into that category. Okay, persons crimes peaked in 1998, the number of people you're going to prison for a person offense. And then you've seen a slow decrease through 2002. Property crimes peaked in 96 and were fairly stable or with a slight decrease until about 2002, and then they went up sharply again. One of the things that the directive from the legislature asked us to do was to look at information on drug offenders in our state institutions. Well, if you look at offenders who are just have drug offenses as their governing sentences, what I mean by governing, that's the sentence that determines how long they will stay in prison, it's their longest sentence. We're undermining the total number of offenders who are in state correctional facilities for drug crimes. So what we did is we looked at the offenders who had governing sentences, and then we also looked at offenders who had secondary or non-governing offenses, meaning they may have had a conviction for a burglary, which was their governing offense, but they had a subsequent conviction for possession of marijuana, because that would be a drug offense also. So when you look at the data here, we broke it down, showing the governing and non-governing, that in 2002, you had 35.4%, over one-third of your admissions, for persons who either had a governing or a non-governing crime that was drug-related. Now, we did not take into consideration, there is a subsequent third group also, is people who do not have a drug conviction but have a substance abuse problem that may have generated the criminal activity, but it was not part of their conviction. We didn't even touch those people. So when we're looking at the number of people in your institutions that have a drug-related problem, this was the best we could do to operationalize it. In 1990, you only had 14.5% of your people in prison admitted to prison for that drug offenses. When we talk about people who are admitted to prison, those are your admissions. And then we talk about people who are in prison. That's called your stock population. And your admissions will not equal your stock population, because the difference in those two things is length of stays. So you can have less people admitted to prison in a given year, but your population will go up because nobody is leaving. So when you look at your stock population, remember I mentioned earlier about the person crime showing a slight decrease and so forth in admissions. But if you look at your chart, you see that that's a red section of your graph. They still make up the largest portion of your prison population because they have the longest sentences. But you look at drugs, which is your green section there, and you can see how that has grown, again, because you have not only an increase in the number of people coming to prison, but you've increased the sentence length. So they're beginning to make a larger and larger portion of your population here. In trying to look at the shift of what's happening in the last 10, 12 years, I think this graph here is a really good one to show you that your population for person offenses has actually dropped. The people you have incarcerated now has gone from 59% of your population to 50%. Your property has decreased. It's gone from 28% to 16%. But if you look at your drug category and your other category, you see significant increases there. Drugs gone from 9% to 23%, and your other category is from 4% to 11%. Again, I caution you on the other category. I think because a lot of those offenses have been developed or instituted in the last 5-6 years, and so you would expect to see that kind of a growth over a 10-year period. Okay. We talked about gender a little bit ago and how it affects your population and admissions. When I talked about the three ways you come into prison, the female admissions here are at all-time high, but 61% of them are coming in on a revocation, meaning they're not being sentenced by the courts directly. They're either coming in as probation revocations or they're coming in as a supervised release population revocation. And that is significantly higher than the overall revocation rates for the population and for males. Okay. We also looked at it by offense type and how people come into a prison for different types of offenses. I think it's important to understand that. For example, your sex offenders. You can see that 57% of your sex offenders are coming in as supervised release returnees. That means they've done their prison time, they're out on supervision in the back end, they violate and they're coming back in. That's a large percentage coming on that end. Drug offenders, you see 57% of them are coming in on initial court commits. And then you have the violator issue coming in on the back end. You also see a high supervised release violation rate for person crimes or other person crimes. That is to be expected. Whenever someone has been incarcerated for a serious crime, their supervision is more intense and their accountability higher, so you would expect that to see the supervision rates to be higher on those more serious crimes. I mentioned earlier about the different degrees, the 5 degrees of drug offenses. First and second degree are presumptive prison, meaning that everybody on those degrees, for all criminal history categories, should be getting direct prison sentences. However, if you look at your admissions to prison by your degrees, your largest admission rate is coming from your fifth degree, which is your lowest level of drug degree, meaning that you have to, these are presumptive probation cases, basically, or stay cases, and they're coming in as violators. Both in the front and the back end. You have to have six plus points on your criminal history to get a prison sentence on a fifth level drug degree case. So these are people who are coming in. And that represents about 1,356 offenders that came into prison last year that were fifth degree drug offenders. Again, looking at that, you can see that 52% of those were probation violators. Another 17% were supervised release. So you have almost 70 or 69% of your people coming in there as a violator. Also, the criminal history. When you look at the probation violations and so forth, look at the criminal history, because there are these people who have long criminal histories and just continually screw up and finally we just throw them in prison. That's not necessarily the case. Most of the probation violators have 34% had zero criminal history points. Another 20% had one criminal history point. So 54% had one or less criminal history points, making them having a very limited criminal history. On your initial commits from people coming into prison, we saw a fairly similar pattern. 25% had 0 points and 13% had ones. So they are not carrying a long criminal history. One of the things that the directive asked us to do was to calculate the number of prison beds and the cost to the state of Minnesota. If we were to continue incarcerating drug offenders at the same using the same policy over a 10-year projection period. And the chart before you shows that in 2003, we will need approximately 925 prison beds to incarcerate or to house drug offenders. By the year 2012, that will reach 2,667 drug offenders using an annual cost of, or an annual per diem of marginal per diem of $59.79. That will cost the state approximately $58,202,874 over a 12-year projection period. One of the things that is impacting a lot of the drug sentences in Minnesota is your departure rates. And departure rates, departures are dispositional and durational. When we look at the departure rates for drug and non-drug offenses, you can see that drug offenses have a much higher downward mitigated departure rate, meaning they are getting less of a sentence than what the sentencing guidelines or the statutory mandatory minimums and so forth are setting for. The upward departure rates are very similar between the drug and non-drug, but the downwards are the issue. The dispositional departures, that's whenever someone should have gone to prison or they don't go to prison. And mitigated is down, I call them downward, mitigated, upward, or aggravated. You see that the highest mitigated departure rates are for assault, too. They are not getting the sentences, the presumptive sentence. The other category is the second highest, followed by drug offenses. And the reason I bring that up is because the mitigated departure rates for those three crimes exceed the property, other person, and interfamiliar sexual crimes, which you would expect because those are much more serious crimes, and so you would expect that departure rate to be less for those types of offenses. Durational departures, that means that they got less of a sentence or more of a sentence than what the guidelines set forth. And you will see here that 40% of the cases involving drugs got a mitigated durational departure compared to 31% of the other category. You see the aggravated departure rates are the highest for murder and manslaughter and for the sex offenses, which again would stand to reason because those are more serious crimes. So what you see going on with your departures is you have less people actually going to prison when the guidelines call for a prison sentence because they're getting the mitigated departures. And when they do go to prison, they're serving less time. Okay. And we looked at this by degree here, by individual drug degree, the cap to what I was just saying here, that you have people who should have gone to prison. These are all people who should have gone to prison. You can see the breakdown here that criminal history of six or more in the fifth degree, and they're still getting probation under the guidelines. Since methamphetamines has been such an issue and is driving so much of the drug sentencing increases and changes that we've seen over the last couple of years, we looked at first-degree drug offenses, and we broke out the methamphetamine cases from the other first-degree drug cases to see what kind of sentencing pattern is going on with the methamphetamines. And you will see that for the first manufacture of meth, which is your first-degree drug sentence, that of the people who were supposed to go to prison, 27% of those people got probation sentences. The ones that did go to prison, 25% of those got less time than what the guidelines called for. And then about 48% got the sentence that was the presumptive sentence. So you have a little more than half the people for the manufacture of meth not getting the sentence set forth in the statute or the guidelines. The same kind of pattern is a little bit higher for the first possession of meth. You start seeing 31 and 40%, again, departure rates on those cases. And it's that same pattern is prevalent for the second degree also. We were asked to compare drug offenses to other offenses proportionally by the severity levels they are on the sentencing guidelines grid. When we assign people, or when they're put on a sentencing grid, when they share a severity level, they should have common amounts or common harm to the person or society committed by that crime so that they are proportional, getting the same amount of time. As you can see here, severity level 9, which is our most serious first-degree drug offense, is ranked up there with third-degree murder, first-degree manslaughter, and first-degree sex offenses. So what this is telling you is that you're putting the first-degree drug offenses on the same level of harm as your first-degree sex offenses. And we did that for all five of the levels, and you can see that, that again, it's like the second degree is up there with manslaughter. You get down to your fifth degree, you start seeing damage to property and theft-related offenses as far as how they rank. When I mentioned before about the high rates of departures and the drug crimes, I also, we looked at what are the departure rates for the non-drug crimes on those same severity levels. Is there a change, is there a significant difference between that? And you will see that, like, severity level 6, that you have departure rates for mitigated on the drug of 53%, but only 29% on the non-drug crimes. So they're inching close to double the departure rates. You look at severity level 8 drug. Again, looking at the departure rates, they're a little closer there, 37 to 29% mitigated, but still significantly high. You get over to severity level 9, which again is your most severe severity level for drug. It's your highest. Okay, you have a 59% departure rate compared to 19% of your non-drug crimes. So I thought that those were pretty revealing graphs. Okay. One of the things we try to do is to look at a timeline to see what has happened over time that may have been driving both the volume and the length of sentences, because oftentimes what happens is laws are enacted and we do not see immediate results, because if we're increasing a penalty or changing a sentence, say if we're increasing a sentence from 10 to 15 years, you can pass that law and you will have no impact on your prison population until year 11, because they were already serving 10 years. So a lot of times when you start seeing something happening, you say, well, we didn't pass anything last year. We didn't change anything 2 years ago. But that change may have occurred 7, 8, 9 years ago, and it's just kicking in now. So I think it's important to understand historically how some of these things have occurred, because you may be experiencing things that were passed significantly long ago. In 1980, when the guidelines were put in place, there were no presumptive prison sentences for drug offenses, meaning that nobody directly went to prison for a drug offense. In 1986, you separated the amounts separated penalties for different levels based on amounts. And that's like 7 grams or more of narcotics became a severity level 10. 10 doses or more of LSD became a severity level 4 to 6. So you started using the amounts at that point to differentiate the different levels on the sentencing grid. In 1987, probably one of the most significant things, there was different threshold amounts established for crack and cocaine. The threshold for cocaine was 10 grams. The threshold for crack was 3 grams. In 1989, was when the major revision of the drug sentencing laws came into effect. The 5 degrees of the drug levels were established. You also had... I've lost my place here. Bear with me. Okay, so you have this, and you have, and you also did away with the possession with intent to sell, because of the level 1, degrees 1 and 2 were determined to be a large amount, meaning that whether you possessed that amount or you tried to sell amount, you were kingpin. So the intent to sell provision was taken off. In 1991, State v. Russell comes in, which says there's a disparate impact on minorities with a different threshold between crack and cocaine. Thus, the amount of the threshold for crack was then applied to cocaine. So instead of it being 10, it was then reduced to 3. And so again, you have that threshold amount. And then in 1997, you see that same threshold amount applied to heroin. And you see the same threshold amount applied to methamphetamines. And then in 2002, you had the precursor, or 2003, you had the precursor drug. So that's kind of just a thumbnail sketch to see how we got to where we were. Okay. One of the things that the mandate asked us to do was to compare drug sentences in Minnesota to other states. That's a very difficult task to do because every state defines their possession statutes a little bit different, or their intent to sell. And so to come up with really good comparisons across the board, it was very difficult. So we broke it down into two sets of comparisons. Guideline states, because guideline states look at sentencing a lot like Minnesota does. They have departures and they have different levels on the grids and so forth. So we looked at different states that had guidelines. We also used the statutory maximum. Now, it should be understood that statutory maximum is not the sentence that the offender gets all the time, but it's something that is concrete, it's measurable, it doesn't change, and it's across the board. And we felt it was one of the best measures for us to use to see where we stand in line with other states. We did put in the presumptive duration, which is the presumptive sentence that most people were supposed to get, even though there was a statutory max, this was the sentence that most people were getting. So when you look at them, we looked at that for cocaine and meth, because those were two crimes that were fairly consistent across guideline states. If you look at the statutory maximum for drug sale or possession with intent to sell, Minnesota's 30 years, doesn't look really out of line with the rest of the statutory maxes. I mean, there's some that are a little bit higher, some that are a little bit lower. But then what, and even their presumptive durations become a little bit different. But if you look at the threshold amounts that are driving those maximum sentences and driving those presumptive sentences, that's where you start seeing the big differences. For 10 grams of cocaine to get a 30-year statutory max sentence in Minnesota, it would take, 1,000 grams in Pennsylvania to get a 20-year max sentence. So your threshold amounts start playing into line there. Okay. We did the same thing with drug possession. I should note there were several states, Utah, Washington, Kansas, that do not use amounts at all, that their possessions are just based on no specific amount. Okay. So what we did was we took an offender. And this offender A and B is going to be sentenced for the same amounts of drugs, possession here, and sales, 10 grams, 25 possession in the different states. And he has no criminal history, so we thought that was the easiest way to do the comparative. And you'll see the different sentences that that offender would get depending on what state he was sentenced in under the guidelines. And it ranges from 86 months to 16 months stay, which would be probation, to 8 to 16 months, or 62 to 72 months, and some with intermediate sanctions imposed. Then we decided to do the difficult task of trying to compare this to other states around Minnesota, other Midwestern states that reflect the same values, the same population mix, the same types of things like that. And we used Illinois, Iowa, Michigan, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. And again, we used the same type of situation, used the statutory max, and then the threshold amounts. And again, you'll see that often our statutory max does not seem extremely out of line with other states around us. When you start looking at the statutory, threshold amounts is when you start seeing the big differences, and how Illinois, to get 60 years, takes 900 grams, 1,000 grams in Michigan. More than 40 grams in Wisconsin for 40 years. So in Minnesota, it's 10 grams for 30 years. And we did the very same thing with the possession. I think the possession even shows a little bit more differences with the different threshold amounts compared to Minnesota having probably one of the lowest amounts or the lowest amount that we could identify. We were asked to do something which became very, very complicated for us, and that was to project what would be the fiscal impact of the state of Minnesota if we were taking low-level nonviolent drug offenders and place them in a non-incarceration type situation without adjusting their sentence. Like, you know, they're going to have the same amount of sentence, but we're going to put them in somewhere else besides the state correctional facility. Well, several things came into play. First of all, the terminology of a nonviolent drug offender is very difficult because it's viewed as that definition is viewed differently by different people. Even among our commission, when we first brought the topic up, there was much division on what constituted a nonviolent drug offender. The commission chose to address that by having a subcommittee, in which we enlarged our subcommittee to include other people in the criminal justice system, from the treatment, from drug courts, more prosecutors, law enforcement, so forth like that, to get their idea and give us input on how to define this. The subcommittee met, and even as if there was division among the commission, there was more division among the subcommittee. And so in order to try to attempt to move forward and to be able to produce this product, we decided probably the easiest thing was to do was to define a violent offender. And if an offender did not fit the definition of violent, then they would be considered nonviolent. Because there was much more agreement, and there was some statutory precedent for the definition of a violent offender also. And in your report, we go into much detail about that. A person who carries or possesses a firearm in the current drug offense. The use of force against a person in the current drug offense would be a violent offender. Death or serious bodily injury in a drug offense. If the drug offense was manufacture of meth or movement of hydronis, I could never pronounce that word, the ammonia that they use in the manufacture of meth would be considered a violent offense. Those things we agreed on. What we could not agree on was whether to include the remaining non-meth-related degrees, 1 and 2 drug offenses in our definition or not. So what we did was we ran two scenarios, one in which we did put the first and second degree offenders in, and other ones where we did not put them in. We also left some discretion to the judges to decide whether people had pending crimes that would make them violent, so that even though we're going to sentence this person right now and there's nothing in his record that would make him violent, we know he has a charge over here that's coming down in a month or so, that would we exclude him. And the other was the someone who would fit the definition on paper, but that court knew something about that offender's behavior that they would deem him to be violent, even though he did not. He would appear to be nonviolent on paper. So we gave the court some discretion there. We ran the different scenarios at different percentages, and you will see here what we did with the treatment costs is we, again, trying to get standardized treatment costs across the state of Minnesota was very difficult in the short period of time we had. But we went to the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Fund, which gives public payment for different types of drug offenses. And that report, that information was detailed by the different levels of drug treatment. And we used their figures, which would have to be recalculated if we were looking at an offender population. It was the best we could do given the time we had. And we came up with an average cost of $4,100, which is very much in line with what the national cost to treat drug offenders, which is between $4,100 and $4,600 on average. And you'll see that the projected cost to the state varied between $4.4 million and about $24.6 million, depending on what scenario you used and so forth. And what we did was take the projected beds that we had using the definitions, applied the per diem, subtracted the treatment costs, and came up with a net saving. And again, I would caution you to be very careful about this. Again, this is a very round ballpark figure. What we couldn't put into the cost of a nonviolent offender was the collateral costs to communities and so forth of having drug offenders in them. We acknowledge that. We know it's a real problem, but to be able to quantify it and put it into a formula like this was something that, given the time span we had to do this report, we're not able to.
Ms. Toombs, I need to leave time for questioning, okay. And we're going to close it at 12. So I'm going to go right to Representative Fuller and then Lipman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is, after seeing all that information, is can you give me a synopsis or, you know, your ideas of what you've learned over, you know, obviously drug crimes are increasing. We're putting more people in prison. Do we have any information on the other crimes, whether violent or not, that were committed along with those offenses. We hear a lot about methamphetamine users being violent and whatnot. Do we have any, you know, information or background? You know, a lot of times you said somebody might have to have 6 points, you know, to be sentenced to prison, those fifth-degree offenders. Do we know what other crimes these people are committing? Is that information anywhere?
When we did the analysis, if they showed up as a drug offense, that means that was their most serious offense. They didn't have another offense with them.
But a lot of times, Mr. Chairman, not to interrupt, but if you're charged with a drug offense and you stole a car at the, you know, the same time, and maybe, you know, that charge was dropped or something, you were committed to, is there any information out there that we have that could tell us those things?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Toombs.
Representative Fuller, we did run the non-drug crimes with the drug crimes. Now, the people that you would be speaking about were the people who had the drug crime as a secondary crime, a non-governing crime. There was a percentage of those that we chose in the charts. If you would want the exact crime they had with that, we could probably go back and look at that data.
Yeah. I don't think you need to do that. I was just curious. Thank you.
Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And then Anderson, and we are going to conclude in 6 minutes. So keep that in mind with your questions and your answers. Representative Lippman.
Mindful, I have a whole bunch that I'm jettisoning so as to provide time for Representative Anderson and others. My brief reply to Representative Fuller, if I may, would be fully a third of the folks who were convicted of the highest level drug crime had a criminal history score of zero, which meant that they didn't have any prior. So if 38%, as according to this report, are being sent for the longest sentences, have no brush with the criminal justice system, and I think it begs the question about whether we're sending the people there, the right people there, for the longest period of time. But my question to you, Ms. Toombs, and it was an excellent report, focuses on pages 71 and 72. And there are two kind of related questions. One, can you tell us a little bit about Table 26 and the savings that might be realized? Can one... I guess my initial question is, can one total up all of the sums that are on the right-hand column for a larger total? And two, is the challenge for policymakers, if we wanted to try and achieve those savings, is the rub to try and cash flow it so that we account for probation costs and other things? Is that the policy riddle that we're facing? So maybe if you can tell me a little bit about Table 26 and how we could get there, or what we need to solve as a committee to realize that money.
Ms. Toom.
My name is Steve Burkhardt. I'm the chair of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and the chair of Olmsted County. Mr. Chair and Representative Lippman, what you're seeing in that panel or that chart is the result of the subcommittee not being able to reach consensus as to whether or not to include certain kinds of drug crimes as inherently violent. They reached consensus that meth-related was inherently violent because of the violence in the cooking process that everybody's aware of. But for these others, they created that group of six conditions. And so in order to accommodate that lack of consensus, because we didn't want to have dissenting reports, they asked the commission and staff to calculate different rates for different scenarios. And so I don't believe that you can total those and come up with a grand sum. Relative to your second question, yes, that is the riddle. We can continue on down the road we're going on. That may be defensible, and I'm sure that there will be those that will argue that that is the case. It simply means building the prison beds to accommodate it. If we choose to try to reduce our Department of Corrections prison costs and instead put them in some kind of treatment or non-incarceration community-based supervision, then we have to improve the capacity to do that at the local level. So there's going to be a cost either way. It's just a matter of how much and how successful can we be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I can yield to other members. I would just direct committee members to Table 8 on page 31. In my estimation, if you're interested in serving on this committee in future terms, be prepared to try and account for a third of $1 billion worth of additional costs unless we make some changes.
We have Representatives Anderson and Ellison. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question was answered.
Representative Ellison.
My question has to do with the rise in women who are incarcerated in connection with drug crimes. Could you speak to the issue of how that impacts the child protection system and account for some of the costs that are... could you speak to that issue, please?
Well, the incarceration of females entails a whole lot of issues that are not faced by male offenders. And there is the breakup, because usually the mother or the female is the primary child care. So they're, you know, the child is put into daycare, I mean, into foster care. I think that's why we see such a high replication rate, because I think we try to keep females in the community with their children as long as possible. However, because most community programs and most drug treatment programs oftentimes do not have the ability or do not meet the specific needs of female offenders. You know, a female addict has a whole lot of issues that are different than a male addict. A female offender who's trying to, you know, get her life back together has a whole lot of other issues going on. And a lot of the programs do not address those types of issues. So they revoke them and put them back in. So I think that's a lot what we're having, is not having the right programs to deal with that population.
Time for one more.
Representative Allison.
Could you take a stab at explaining the downward departure rate for drug offenses? I mean, my experience is that the prosecutor and the defense attorney come together and work a deal out where the judge agrees to do the downward departure. Can you explain, does it reflect community standards? What does it actually reflect, given the high number of downward departures for drug offenses?
Ms. Toombs.
Chairman Smith, Representative. I think what it, you know, there's a certain amount of plea bargaining that goes on in order to get keep our system moving through. So, yes, I think there is some plea bargaining that goes on, and you are correct in the fact that a lot of these are departures and where there's agreement between the parties involved. There is some proportionality issues, I think, among different judiciary members who feel that the sentence does not warrant the length of incarceration given the other offenses that are on that same level.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, an interesting aside occurred when we reported to the Senate Crime Prevention Committee. Gail Baez, who is the prosecutor of the drug court in Hennepin County, also testified and pointed out that that number that you're looking at may be somewhat skewed by a policy from the Hennepin County Drug Court County Attorney's Office relative to plea bargaining. There is their policy to always seek durational downward departures, not dispositional downward departures. So if they have a first-degree charge, they're going to go for a first-degree conviction, but they will deal on the time. They represent more than half of the number of cases coming through the pipe in Minnesota. So it may be their policy that somewhat skews that particular piece of data.
Very good. We'll notify the testifiers. Thank you for being with us today. We'll notify you in advance when this issue resurfaces at this committee level. Until then, thank you, committee. This meeting is adjourned.